This is Reality Proves Possibility. We can do better than this. Hello, everyone. We're here with Reality Proves Possibility. We can do better than this. And I'm very pleased and honored to have Donna Hicks with me here, who is a world-renowned expert on dignity and has been working in international conflicts and now increasingly with businesses in terms of unpacking what dignity is and how it can empower organizations to, yeah, be better. So thank you, Donna, so much for joining. And let me know, what is your initial reaction to Reality Proves Possibility? We can do better than this.
I'm convinced we can do better. You know, I did some work with some young kids who had been victims of terrorism. And these young kids, after they learned the dignity model and understood what it was all about, the first thing that they said is, you know what? We can do better. And for out of the mouth of babes, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, we can do this. We can do this. So we definitely can do this. And I think part of the problem is that we have decreased expectations of what we're capable of. So we have to increase those expectations of what we're capable of. That's the goal.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yes, because we can do better. We have shown it over time. The reason why we're here as humans is that we're a result of an evolutionary process that allowed us to, yeah, become a dominant species on this planet. And while we're sort of risking our own survival, I think, Donna, you and your work shows us in some way how can we get back to basics and use the term dignity, but maybe just share with us a little bit, like what is it that you at the core are sharing when you go around the world?
Well, I think it's such a simple truth. It's nothing, you know, seismic. I mean, it's seismic in its effect, but the reality of the truth about dignity is so plain. It's, you know, I didn't have to go to Harvard and to figure this out and to be there for 30 years. All I had to do was go around the world and observe what happened to people when they have not been treated well. So, Michael, I'm hearing that sound again. Are you hearing it?
Mm-hmm.
Should I turn it off again?
No, let's just go with it.
And okay. I don't know why. Yeah. Okay. So when I've worked all over the world, I realized that this yearning for dignity was universal. That, you know, I expected maybe people would think differently about dignity in one part of the world or the other. But the fact is, everybody wants to be treated as if they matter. And everybody wants an opportunity to grow and to flourish and become and evolve, as you just mentioned, evolve into human beings that, in a way that, you know, increases their consciousness about the world and each other and ourselves. So this is very simple. We all want this. We all want to be treated well. And again, it is something that even little kids understand. It's not rocket science.
So Donna, thank you so much. I'm going to have to pause here because this noise is getting quite big. I don't know what's going on. I have this special software here, and it's just really, really not working.
Never had this before?
Never. Now, this is only my third, you know, so I'm not saying that I have the...
Well, I just turned it off and put it back on again, so...
Yeah, that's what worked last time for about 5 minutes, right? So... We're gonna continue the conversation, just maybe doing that maybe a couple times if that works. I'm trying to see if there's anything.
Yeah. Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Okay. So, all right, somehow maybe it's on coming through yours because I didn't pause anything. So maybe we'll do that a couple times when it comes on again. Okay, so I'll just put a marker here.
So you'll edit this anyway, right?
I'll have to edit it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think I answered that last question, so you might want to just start with a new one.
Exactly. So Donna, maybe just briefly for our audience, some of them are familiar with the Dignity Model and your work, others are not or may not be. So maybe just give a little bit of a general introduction of your work, how you came to it, what the insight was, and what do you think is critical for us in terms of understanding. You say it's very simple, but seismic in its consequences. So maybe just give us the short intro.
Yeah, I spent most of my career at Harvard running a program called the Program on International Conflict Analysis and Resolution. And this program would people would call us and contact us and say, "Hey, look, we know that you have a methodology where it's a social psychological methodology for helping people resolve conflicts." So it was unique in that sense that it was psychological and not, interest-based or realpolitik-based or anything. So we would go all over the world, helping people try to make progress on their peace processes. But inevitably, no matter where we were, we discovered that there was an underlying reaction to things that were being said at the table. And in fact, I often think about the fact that we had two conversations going, one at the top of the table where we were talking about the political issues that divided the parties, and we had another conversation without words that was taking place under the table. And that conversation was explosive. It was like an emotional hurricane. And it would derail all the good work that we had done up to that point. And so I kept seeing this everywhere I went, Michael, and I realized, wait a minute, there is something else going on here, and I have to explore it with the party. So I one time explored it, when this one guy had a giant reaction to something that was being said. And when I say giant reaction, I just mean emotional. He got very upset, red-faced, pushed himself back from the table, arms crossed. And anyway, to make a very long story short, it took me several tries to figure out how to talk about that because they hated the word emotions. When I would say to them, "Wow, that was such a big emotional reaction. Can you talk about it?" They hated that. They would say, "This isn't about emotions. This is about justice. This is about identity. This is..." I said, "Okay, fine, fine." So I tried another word. I tried the word trauma the next time it happened because it happened inevitably. And they hated that word because they didn't like to be thought of as weak and traumatized. So finally, I came up with this word dignity because what was so clear to me was that what was happening was it was a human reaction to how they were being treated by the other side. And I got to turn this off again. And it was really a reaction to how they'd been treated. And when I said to them, "Hey, look, it sounds to me like you have experienced a lot of dignity assaults and a lot of violations to your dignity. No wonder you're having a response like this." And when I framed it that way, Michael, they were so willing to talk about it, and they would say to me, "Yes, that's exactly what's going on here." And I think they felt validated by that word. Our dignity has been assaulted. And that their struggle was legitimate. We were fighting for our dignity. And so that's how the whole thing started. And I ended up writing about it in my first book. It was about dignity and its essential role in resolving conflict. And when that came out, I got calls. I thought mostly it would be from my community, my international conflict community. But I got calls from the corporate world, from healthcare, from schools, from universities, from NGOs, all kinds of organizations that said, "I think you might have nailed our issue. I think there's a lot of unspoken and implicit dignity issues floating around our culture, and we're not naming it. We're not talking about it." So that opened doors. Like you said, more recently, I've been working in the business world, in the corporate world, business schools, and in addition to other healthcare and education. But I do believe that, as I said earlier, because this is a fundamentally human response to being treated badly, it is universal. You know, I always say it's our highest common denominator as human beings. We all want this desperately. And you know, in my business, we often talk about trying to find common ground in order to find compromises and all that. And I, you know, now I don't believe in that anymore. I really think what we need is higher ground. And I think this issue of dignity elevates us, or it could elevate us, if we choose, if we choose to pay attention to it, and if we choose to educate ourselves, and but the problem is, you know, up until most recently, there have been very few courses or introductions of dignity and dignity leadership into MBA programs and businesses and so on, business schools. So now with your help, you and I are on the road doing this together. So it's been a challenge on one hand, but on the other hand, the response to this framing of dignity, I mean, you've reframed a whole new business paradigm, but with dignity at the core of it. So that partnership that I think that we have, where humanistic leadership is embracing 100%, embracing this notion of dignity at the core of this new paradigm. So I think we've really opened up doors, Michael, that would have never been accessible to us if we had tried this alone. You know, I'm so, after we, you and I just spent a week in Spain and delivered this message, and the response was so remarkable to me. I mean, it was just remarkable how people wanted to hear more about what is this new paradigm, Michael? What is that, Donna? What is dignity? How does it fit into leadership? And so that's where we are.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
Great. So this partnership that we have is fantastic because we are able to sort of get people to see things newly. And I sort of get from many people a reaction is like, oh my God, this is so trivial, it's so obvious, and we don't see it. And you're able, we're in the process of making people aware of the power of dignity. What would you say are the core elements of dignity for everybody to see?
So, yeah, before I get to that, one of the things that I often hear is that, yeah, this is just common sense. Of course we have to treat each other. Of course we're going to react badly when someone treats us as if we are inferior. But, you know, I say to them immediately, well, look, this might be common sense, but it's not common knowledge, and it's not common practice, more importantly. And what we have to do is help people visualize and understand what it looks like to treat someone with dignity. And I, in response to your question, I came up with some research, interviewed people from all over the world and asked them to tell me about a time when they felt they had their dignity honored and a time when they felt they had their dignity violated. And I was really expecting to hear differences, you know, interviewing people from Asia and Africa, North America, South America, Europe. I was shocked that I fundamentally, when it came to the emotional piece of this, of what it was like to have their dignity violated, especially, they told me way more stories about when they were violated. It was all the same, in which just completely confirmed my suspicion that this is a universal human issue. It's unique to our species. And so anyway, I came up with these 10 elements of dignity. The first one is identity. Everybody wants their identity accepted, no matter who they are, no matter their race, their religion, their ethnicity, their physical capabilities. So people want to be thought of as being equal in dignity, even when we differ in status, you know. And in fact, when we have authority over people and we have more status and power, it's more of a responsibility for us to treat everybody with dignity. Second one is recognition. People want to be recognized for the good work that they've done. They want, you know, I would say praise, but they just want to be acknowledged that what they have done, their work they have done, has contributed, and thank you very much for a good job. The other thing is acknowledgement. Acknowledgement is probably one of the most significant, I think, elements of dignity, because I had worked with Archbishop Tutu for several years, and he told me, when I asked him this question, I said, "Arch, what do you think it takes for people to put the past to rest and to move on in their lives after they've been treated badly?" And he said, you know, really, fundamentally, he said, when people have been roughed up, they need acknowledgement for the suffering they've endured. And we need people to say to us, "Oh my gosh, Michael, that was horrible what you went through. That was..." And it doesn't even have to be the person who did the perpetrated the harm. So this is a key one, especially for healing, because when these dignity violations happen, we need to heal from them. And just as a little parenthesis here, there's research that shows that when people experience a violation to their dignity, that it shows up in the brain in the same area as a physical injury. So that's no small matter. And in fact, when I take that information into the corporate world or wherever I'm consulting, I say, look, we have to pay attention to this. This really does matter. Because the brain experiences a dignity wound just like it would experience a physical injury. And that usually shifts doubt when people have doubt about this. So that's really important. So acknowledgement's important, accepting identity, recognition, inclusion. Of course, we all know, we've all been exposed to the whole DEI movement. People want that sense of belonging. Safety. This is a big one. And it's not just physical safety, but also psychological safety. People want to feel safe to speak up if something bad happens to them. Fairness, that's like equity, fairness. Independence, people don't like to be micromanaged. They like to feel free and you know, capable of making decisions for themselves. Understanding, this is a big one, because we humans, we're pretty good at judging one another. In fact, judgment comes pretty quickly. But what we have to do is push the pause button on that judgment, because people really want to be heard. People want to be listened to. People want to be understood. So that's a key one, especially with all this polarization that we have in our world right now. We just need to be better listeners, and we need to, and second, another one of these elements, we need to give people the benefit of the doubt that they're acting the way they are for some good reason. I mean, not to say you have to agree with it, but... And finally, accountability. When somebody violates our dignity, we want them to apologize. We want them to take responsibility for the harm that they've, you know, perpetrated on us. So these 10 ways that are what I call the 10 elements of dignity really helps people understand in their day-to-day interactions with others what it looks like to be in a relationship where both parties feel seen, feel heard, feel listened to, feel responded to. And so what the research shows is that when people feel like these 10 elements are in play, they're part of the exchange in the relationship, they feel trust. They feel a deep connection, and they certainly feel safe. And the one thing about safety I wanted to point out in these elements is that when I first went into the corporate world and did interviews with people and I presented these 10 elements, I said to them, "Oh, tell me which one is most often violated in your workplace. And 80% of them, Michael, said safety. And I thought, "Whoa, you don't mean physical safety?" And they said, "No, we don't feel safe to speak up when our boss or our supervisor, you know, violates our dignity, we feel like we'll maybe lose our job. You know, we'll have a bad performance review. So people just keep that stuff. They stuff it down. And that's where the toxic cultures come in, Michael.
Yeah. Thank you. And the obvious evidence that we all have is in terms of people disengaged at their work, the presentism, and basically lots of things come from that. And we're talking about the goal, once you have dignity in place in the terms of humanistic management or leadership, is really the contribution to flourishing ourselves and that of others. And that typically that reciprocal effect actually elevates all of humanity in a way that you describe, right? The highest common denominator as a baseline to then really go for flourishing. And all the good things seem to come from that. And much of the research is totally in line with that. It's just that the practice oftentimes is completely off. Yeah. And we still talk about real world as if this was unreal. But reality proves possibility. So maybe you can share some examples when you know that dignity sort of recognition and a dignity culture has actually allowed people to heal, to build trust, to recover, to work together better.
Well, you know, what I do when I go into an organization that's hired me to try to address the toxic work culture and try to create a culture of dignity, what I do is I try my best not to shame people, especially in the leadership roles, because, you know, what we want is a change in behavior. You know, we don't want people to feel like they're being marginalized or fingers pointed at them. So the first thing that I think is important in understanding what it takes and what it means to lead with dignity and to try to create a culture that is dignity honoring is, you know, we've made some mistakes in the past. You know, we have our ignorance surrounding this issue of dignity is enormous. And is there any wonder this has never been taught in, at the time anyway, now it is, but at the time it had never been taught in business schools, you know, how to treat people with dignity. Certainly we didn't learn it in, you know, grammar school or high school, even universities, you know. So this is what I try to do to get rid of the shame, is I try to say to them, look, you've never been exposed to this. You know, you've never been exposed to this. There's a reason why you might be unconsciously and unknowingly violating dignity of people. And I think it's true for all of us. You know, it wasn't until I learned this stuff in my midlife that I recognized how much I had become a dignity violator myself. So it's something that we all have experienced, you know, when we get angry, and especially when we get triggered and somebody gets us so upset and we, you know, we lash back, we try to get even, we want revenge. And those are normal human reactions to, you know, to having our dignity violated. So I really try to, when I go in and work with a team, especially with the leadership team, but the work I do is with the entire organization. It's not just the leadership, but I do start with the leadership because my experience has been that so many people in leadership positions with good intentions can violate dignity without knowing it. So we have to, and they set the tone. They develop policy, you know, because there are structural indignities that we have to deal with, as well as just these interpersonal skills that we're trying to develop. So I would go in and I would work with a leadership team for, you know, several sessions. And then I would go into all the different departments and work with the managers and the supervisors there. And I would meet with all of the employees, not just the managers and supervisors, but because I want to hear their stories, like that one I just told you about safety. I would have never known that if I hadn't asked. So it's a system-wide approach to trying to not only develop individual skills with people, but try to address some of the bigger structural issues that are at play. you know, I have my friend and colleague Ron Heifetz had taught me that, you know, when you're trying to transform an organization or a system, you have to look at the bigger forces that are acting upon an organization as well, you know, systemic forces like racism, sexism, and all the isms. So we try to work at all of those different levels and units of analysis. And, you know, I have had some pretty amazing successes. And I think starting out, as I just said, starting out trying to eliminate the shame from the process and from the experience, because, you know, I tell them, hey, look, I was a dignity violator too. I had to learn this. I'm just here to help you learn what I've learned, you know? So it kind of calms people down, like, oh, I don't have to feel like I'm the bad guy or the, you know, bad woman or bad whatever. So it's an approach that gives people a lot of latitude to learn. And I always say, look, you know, we have to be open to learning, because it's the only way out of this. It's the only way out of it if we know that we can do better. We have to accept, yes, and as I said before, increase our expectations of what we're capable of. And I say to them, look, if you're going to lead people, you better understand them. And dignity is at the core of what these people want. So
wonderful. And maybe we can go to some examples or you can throw them in. But I know that you have been working and gotten all of that sort of insight through your work in international conflicts. And maybe you want to mention some of them. But I also know your work with Desmond Tutu in Northern Ireland and other places. So maybe just recap, what is it sort of, what did you learn from working with Desmond Tutu? What are sort of the nuggets that you can share with us? And what are some of the key things that you think are sort of universally human? I think you remember, you mentioned the three C's, right? The three C's of dignity, sort of.
Well, I'll do that.
Maybe you'll just share also about that. So maybe lessons from working with Archbishop Tutu and then the three C's,
I learned so much from Archbishop Tutu that it's hard to, like, so many ideas are coming to the fore right now. But as I mentioned about acknowledgement, how important acknowledgement is, that when we humans experience, you know, a terrible, you know, assaults to our dignity, we need acknowledgement for the suffering that that put us through. So that was fundamental. But also, I think more than anything else was his belief in dignity. And I learned a lot about dignity from him, because in the early days, I thought that we could have our dignity stripped from us when somebody mistreats us, you know, and in fact, so many of the parties that I worked with said, we had our dignity stripped, and that's why we're fighting to regain our lost dignity. And I told the Archbishop that story once, and he got so mad at me. And I said, what's the matter? What happened? And he said, are you telling people that they can have their dignity stripped? And I said, oh, no, that's just what they said. Well, truth is, I did sort of believe it. And he said, look, he said, how do you think we Black South Africans got through apartheid, that most dehumanizing regime in history? How do you think we got through that? And he said to me, we got through it because we knew that our dignity was in our hands and our hands only, and we were never willing to give it up. So, you know, he has this fundamental belief that we're born with this dignity. And for him, it was a God-given gift, this dignity. And you know, it's inside us. It's in our soul. It's in every cell of our being, he says. And, you know, he said, what do you think happened to Nelson Mandela? He was 27 years in this prison where he wasn't even treated like a human being. And he said, that guy got through because he knew. And there's a quote in his book that he says that when he got into the prison in Mandela, he realized that one of the strategies of the guards was to try to strip people of their dignity. And he said, well, I figured that out in about 20 minutes because I realized nobody is going to win that game of taking my dignity away, because my dignity is in my hands and I will never let go of it. So these two profound human beings who have gotten through so much adversity in their lives, they came out with this fundamental belief that nobody could take their dignity away from them. And that was a sea change for me, I have to say. And so that was remarkable. But was also remarkable when we did those the BBC television programs together up in Northern Ireland in Belfast, where we had victims and perpetrators of the conflict there. And that this was after the peace 1998 peace accords were signed. And the problem was that there was still anger and hatred in the streets of Belfast. So the BBC thought, well, let's do these encounters and bring Archbishop Tutu, like he did that in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. He had such a great experience there. We're going to bring him up here and see. Anyway, I joined him in that enterprise. And one of the things that struck me, to this day, I can't even reproduce it, but the way he would approach people, no matter whether they were the victims or the perpetrators of these heinous crimes, he would give 100% of his attention to both of them. And he never judged them. He never, you know, especially the perpetrators, of course. And we had some pretty grisly perpetrators there with us in this program. And I would be so scared, you know, I said to him once, I don't know if I can be as empathic as you are. I told him, your empathy is just flowing here, no matter whether you're dealing with the victim or the perpetrator. I don't know if I can do that. And he said, yes, you can. You can do it. He said, if you don't see their dignity right away, keep on digging. That's what he told me. Keep on dignity, because it's there. His dignity is there. And I say his because these were all male perpetrators. So that I learned, you know, sit with my own lack of empathy, try to look closer, try to get some piece of his story. And then, you know, we can use that with each other. And this isn't just about international conflicts. These are skills that we can use, especially right now with so much polarization. How do we try to stay connected with that empathy that is a natural, it's a natural human response? The problem is, in times of conflict, it's the first thing that goes out the window. So I learned that. I learned to be patient. You know, he was so gifted, and I felt like I was so blessed to be working with him. And it's one thing to read his books and everything. His books are great, but to see him in action, the way he was with people, he was just an extraordinary human being. And, you know, to this day, I always call on him, because he told me once, you know, you got to call on your ancestors when you need help. And I call on him all the time when I'm in a tough place. Yeah.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a 5-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcasts.
That's great. That's fantastic. What do you think, sort of as I'm nuggets for anyone who is leading, well, which we are all everywhere, we're leading our lives. But if we're in a business context where oftentimes it's like competition, you see, you said Ron Heifetz, it's like you have to understand the system and the pressures, and there's oftentimes this perception of a fight. Some competition will take something away from you if you're not sort of performing at whatever level. So oftentimes, not only empathy goes out, but the awareness of dignity goes out in that kind of, that people describe as dog-eat-dog world, right? So what would you say is possible to implement right now, today, for anyone that wants to be leading more dignity conscious?
Yeah, I think most importantly is as I just pointed out about patience, having patience, because I mean, part of our evolutionary history is that when we get angry and we get in a fight with somebody, there's a part of our brain that takes over that is not dignity centered. Let me tell you, it's get rid of the threat. That part of the brain wants to destroy the enemy, wants to destroy the competition. It's part of our evolutionary history. And I call them the 10 temptations. I've got the temptations to violate not only our own dignity, but the dignity of others. And we get triggered and we respond as if our lives were on the line. Metaphorically, we respond that way, even if it's a psychological hit that we're taking. And so we just, again, this is some evidence that I got, learned from talking to neuroscientists. And that is, they say, when we feel that big response coming on, that triggered response, to just push the pause button. Think metaphorically in our heads, just push that pause button. I'm triggered right now. Say, I'm acting out of self-preservation right now. And I know my life isn't on the line here. So I'm going to push the pause button. And Heifetz, again, he talks about going to the balcony, taking a trip up to the balcony. And, you know, it's just, again, a metaphorical pause. We are imagining ourselves getting up, you know, 30,000 feet and looking down at ourselves. Maybe not 30,000, maybe 3,000. And we're looking down at ourselves and saying to ourselves, how do I want to react in this situation? Do I want to be a dignity violator? Or do I want to protect my own dignity and not perpetrate and not, you know, take the bait and return the harm here? I do not want to return the harm. Because I think that should be our mantra, do no harm. You know, we hear that in the medical world, but I think we, as leaders of people, we also have to say to ourselves, I want to do no harm. It's a simple self command, you know, do no harm. And now that we know how much we can harm each other by violating each other's dignity, we push that pause button, go up to the balcony, get ourselves into control again, and take a few deep breaths. That's the other thing that the neuroscientist taught me. You know, sometimes people say, count to 10. She said to me, no, don't count to 10. That'll do nothing. You have to take 10 deep breaths, because she told me that it connects the vagus nerve in our gut with that brain that's all on fire and calms us down. So that little nugget has helped me so many times, Michael. You know, that impulse to lash back, that impulse to say, what? Anyway, we all know, we all probably have different responses. I mean, it's either fight or flight. We know this from evolutionary biology. We are wired for fight. We know how to fight. And what's harder is to know that we can actually react differently. We have another part of our brain and our neocortex that enables us to push the pause button, that enables us to not take the bait, that enables us to take responsibility. Because who knows, maybe we've contributed to the problem. And to just hold the mirror up and say, gee, what might I have done here to cause this rift between me and this other person? So it's a lot of self-talk. It's a lot of self-awareness. And it's just something that has to be learned. We have to learn this. This is not something that comes naturally, because these self-preservation instincts come on just like that. They're so fast and furious when we feel like we've been wronged. And but, you know, the fact that the neural pathway there to threat as a reaction to threat is so ancient in us, that these self-preservation instincts can take over our behavior in a nanosecond. And, you know, we like to think of ourselves as pretty good people. We don't like to think of ourselves as a dignity violator or harming others. So it just takes practice, Michael. It's like learning anything else. You know, think of the years that we spend learning mathematics and science and history. And, you know, if we put in a fraction of that time to learning how to be together with each other, how to promote human connection rather than human disconnection, we're really good at disconnection. We don't even have to think about that. Our brain takes over and wants us to pummel the other person. So you get the point.
Yeah, and I think this sort of resonates, and you mentioned this a couple times also in other conversations, that this is sort of the wisdom of the ancient spiritual traditions also, right? And I think recovered through modern psychology in some way, where really the pause and the grace with self and others is really a pathway towards transcendence, or transcending these biological mechanisms that exist. And I think that who said it, is like biology is destiny unless you ignore it.
Yes.
So there are so many pieces coming together. And I want to say this is like the humanistic perspective, right? This is where all of the universal ancient wisdom traditions and the modern science converge, and the science from quantum physics to evolutionary biology to sociology to many of those that give us more insights about the existential questions: who are we, what do we want, where, and how do we get there, right? And those are managerial questions. And I think, like, taking this concept or shell or shortcut of dignity can be very helpful, where it's like, yes, we want to be treated as if we matter, and help us each other to get into that position, right? Because that's when good things happen. Now, I want to give you space for just some final observations, comments, and what I do is also use Marcel Proust's questionnaire. And there are 35 questions, so I just want you to give me a number between 1 and 35, and then I'll ask you something.
26 just came to my mind.
26, excellent. Okay, let me see what 26 is. What do you most value in your friends?
What do I most value in my friends? Can you hear me, Michael? Okay. I just love the connection. I love feeling like we feel safe being around each other. We're not worried about being judged. That we can be playful, you know, that we can have have fun together. I mean, I've been telling you this about how Desmond Tutu taught. Here's another nugget from Tutu that he says, you know, we have to put, when things are so bad in the world and so negative, we have to put positive energy into the world. That's our duty. And he said, yes, and never forget, it's our duty to be joyful. So I think when you feel safe in a relationship, like with a friendship, and you can be your authentic self, and you can play, as I said, you can play together and you can be joyful together and not have to, you know, worry about anybody else's reaction. We are just in it together. That's the point. We're connected and we're in it together. And to me, that's one of the best things we can hope for in life.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Any final comment, anything you want to share with listeners? What are some of the things that I think you wish you had known earlier, and that you think can help us right now? Reality proves possibility. We are, you know, you're talking from real life experiences, and you know that we can do better than this. What are some of the final observations?
Well, you had brought this up earlier, but what I've come to understand about dignity and dignity consciousness, once we've become dignity conscious, we three things happen when we become dignity conscious. And what are those? What does that mean? What are those three things? The first thing is connection. Second thing is connection. And the third thing is connection. Connection, connection, connection. Well, what is that? First of all, we have to be connected to our own dignity. This is like the major part of the work that I do with people, because most people haven't really embraced and accepted their own dignity. Self-doubt takes over so much more powerfully than self-compassion and self-love that dignity brings. So one of the major points is get connected to your own dignity. Don't waste that power. That power is there within you, and it makes us resilient. It makes us, you know, it helps us connect with other people. And because that's the second connection, is to the dignity of others. Because if I've got dignity and I'm a human being and everybody else is a human being, they've got it as well. There's nothing unique about me. And that's the difference between narcissism and this, what I'm talking about. Narcissism thinks they are better than everybody else. Uh-uh. When we're all sharing, this is a shared aspect of our humanity. We all have dignity. Everybody does. So it's connection to our own dignity, connection to the dignity of others. And third is a connection to something bigger than ourselves, something greater than ourselves. You know, faith communities like to think about this in terms of their connection to the divine. You know, other students, for example, would say, well, you know, I think the connection that I really want to develop is a connection to the greater good. I want to do some kind of work that brings out the best in people and gives me a purpose, gives me meaning to my life. And then the consequence is that I contribute to the greater good. And so that connection to something bigger, a bigger purpose, a bigger sense of meaning. It's not just, I want to go out and buy this house or that car or this or that. I want to contribute. I want to try to make the world a better place. And I think those three C's, what I call them, the three C's, that is the secret to a fulfilled life. Once we have those three pieces in alignment, our own dignity, dignity of others, and to something bigger, I think that's what happiness is. That's what fulfillment looks like. So that's the final message. But most importantly, don't forget your own dignity.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Donna. And there's so much more to talk about in terms of how this connects and allows people to manage themselves and others better. We call it humanistic management. So, Donna, you have two books that people can refer to, which is Dignity and then Leading with Dignity. And we have recently published in Harvard Business Review on Leading with Dignity. And we're also reframing DEI through the lens of dignity. And so there are lots more to talk about, and I'm sure we'll get to do that soon. So I thank you so much, Donna, for being here with me. And yeah, have a great day. Reality does indeed prove possibility. And we can do better than what we're experiencing right now.
And we will do better. Not only yes. We can, but we will. That's the Perfect. Declaration. Okay. Thank you. It's just been wonderful.
Thank you.